Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in for Mike Collins. Household debt in this country is high and getting higher. According to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, it increased by $150 billion in the third quarter of this year alone. Debt is not a one-size-fits-all situation. It can look different from person to person, from student loans to credit cards, cards to cars, and personal loans. There are plenty of ways to borrow money, and if you're not careful, get underwater quickly. It can be overwhelming knowing where to start when it comes to managing money. How do you combat what can feel like never-ending debt? How much money should you be trying to save on a monthly basis? And what about retirement? How do you talk to your parents about financial needs as they age? And how do you keep realistic financial goals while holding yourself accountable? We've got just the expert to tackle these questions and more. Bernadette Joy is a personal finance author and Charlotte resident who understands the complexities around money management decisions. And she joins us to discuss her life, techniques to pay down debt, including how to achieve financial independence, and of course, to discuss her new book, Crush Your Money Goals, 25 Smart Money Habits to Save, Invest, and Fast Track Your Financial Freedom. That's this hour on Charlotte Talks. Bernadette, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first off, I wanted to start with talking about your personal story, which I imagine led you to write this book. You paid off, I believe, $300,000 worth of debt in 3 years and invested your first $1 million of net worth in your 30s. You've also, been just very vocal about helping people unlock these secrets. And I wanted to start off by sharing, by having you share, what kind of debt did you have, and how did you decide when you did that it was the right time to pay it off?
Well, thank you for asking that. And people ask me when I wrote this book, how long did it take? And I tell people all the time, it took me 8 years since 2016, which is when I started this personal finance journey. And it started off really even before that with, I'm sure a lot of people in Charlotte can relate. We try and go get a good job. We get a good college education. We try to buy the pretty house and the 2.5 kids and the one dog. And I was doing all of those things. And in 2016, I had decided to start and finish an MBA program that was multi-six figures. So a good chunk of that $300,000 was student loans, which I know a lot of people can relate to. And then the rest of it were like the usual bills, the things that we, credit cards and cars, and part of it was my mortgage at the time as well. And I remember specifically in January 2016, I had 10 weeks left in my MBA program, and I went to go check how much I had in my student loans. And I was literally floored, as in I fell to the floor when I realized I had $72,000 of student loans and no plan to pay it back. Mm. And that is really what kickstarted me, as I'm sure many people do, is when they realize where they are financially. I did the very smart thing, which is I just went to Google and started Googling, how do I pay off debt? How do I pay off student loans? How do I pay them faster? And a lot of the information I found was kind of generic and didn't really speak to me, particularly as a woman and a first-generation Filipino-American, and that's when I started on my personal finance journey.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up your background and your heritage, because there is and I always get nervous before I read, the person who wrote it, but I'm going to try my best to read your writing in front of it. And it leads to my next question, which is talking about the importance of finding a financial advisor or mentor who looks like you, who has some background, who can understand where you're coming from. So you write, find an advisor who gets you. My experience with traditional financial advisors, 72.1% of whom are white, was difficult as an Asian American woman. Discussing finances with someone who did not know me personally felt invasive and uncomfortable, especially when they assumed that their money experience was similar to mine. My last financial advisor was only interested in speaking about investments. When my biggest stressor was paying my student loans and mortgages, he did not understand that I had grown up with a deep emphasis on education and was carrying shame inherited from my Filipino immigrant parents around my debt. Look for mentors who will take the time to get to know you as a whole person. I think that's really good advice, but how do you find that person who will look at you like a whole person?
Yes. Well, good job on reading that. That was excellent.
Thank you.
So I have a couple of tips that I have for people on specifically finding a financial advisor. The first question is, do you really need a financial advisor at this point? Unless you have accumulated at least 250K or more of investments, you're really not at a point, in my opinion, that you even need a financial advisor. And truth be told, I learned this the hard way. Most financial advisors don't even want to talk to you because they're not going to make money off of you if you at least have that amount. So when I say looking for a financial advisor, what I mean really mean is finding a mentor, a coach. It potentially could be a financial advisor, but doesn't have to be someone who has the title of financial advisor. And specifically, I would look for a couple of things. Number one is I would upfront want to know what their net worth is. And I say that because there are a lot of people, no shade, who are giving out money advice who don't have money. And so you want to know, and not to, it's not to say that they have to have, oh, $1 million net worth, but they should have a net worth that is on the trajectory of where you want to be. I actually met a financial advisor in Charlotte who she was telling people all the usual stuff that all the other financial advisors were saying. And then I found out after the fact that she had about a $300,000 net worth, and she had done that coming out of a very difficult divorce. And I said, that's what you should be talking about to women. They don't want the usual suspect from a financial advisor. They want someone who has experienced what they've experienced. And $300,000 is still way more than the average for the US, right? So I first look at for net worth. Number two is interview them on what their past experience has been, what are their money beliefs, what are their generational kind of traumas around finances, which a lot of people are not willing to talk to you. But I think a lot of people say they resonate with my book and what I teach is because I'm very transparent about my mental health challenges in the past. I've been transparent about things that I've had to deal with within my interpersonal family. I'm also very transparent to folks that I'm child-free by choice, and that's something that people care about. So find someone who has some common beliefs. And then the last thing is simply to ask for receipts. Ask for at least three clients that they've had who are willing to speak to their experience with that person, and not just look at their websites, not just look at the testimonials. You want to talk to at least three other people who have actually worked with them for a significant amount of time to see what their experience was like and how they were treated. Because I can tell you there's a lot of financial coaches and the financial advisors who want to talk over you rather than talk with you.
Well, in the book, you discuss the role that your family and your parents in particular played in influencing the way you look at work, climbing the corporate ladder, and how you save money and how you budget. So I was wondering if you could share with our listeners what was the approach that your parents had with money growing up, and how did that influence you?
Yes, so I had a pretty complicated family structure. My father was married twice. He had seven children with his first wife and then two children with his second wife. I'm being the eighth of nine. And so the rhetoric was consistently, we don't have money and you need to work really hard, pretty much, which I think a lot of people can relate to. We can't afford that. And you need to be the best student, get the best job, get a stable job. And so it took me a really long time, and I'm still unraveling that today. I would love to tell you that I have fully overcome that. But I had this thought yesterday, actually, since the book came out recently. My father passed away in 2021, and it's kind of a bittersweet moment because I wish he was here to see the book because he was so scared when I told him I was going to quit my job and become an entrepreneur and become a financial coach. Because from what he understood as a Filipino, who immigrated from the Philippines, that the way that you become financially stable in the US is you go get a job at a Fortune 100 company and then you buy the house and you do all the things. And so when I did the opposite of a lot of things that they wanted me to do, i.e., I sold my house, I decided to quit that stable job, I took out a ton of money on student loans, they were really worried. And I realize in hindsight, and I think a lot of people can relate to this, is that sometimes it feels like when you're going on your own personal finance journey that people are unsupportive. But I realize it was really just more of a projection of their fears onto me versus questioning what I was doing.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that fear in a little bit. But first, I wanted to ask you about the types of people that you typically help coach. Is it mostly women? Is it a specific socioeconomic background? Or what's the diversity there?
You know, what's interesting is that I held a summit in Charlotte recently, and one of my other clients, she said to me afterwards, she said, I could look around the room and I could not pinpoint a particular, at least physical trait that you could say was my client, because there was the age range was from 20 to 70 and all different kind of races and socioeconomic backgrounds, as well as net worths. I've had people who have had hundreds of thousands of dollars in the negative, and I've had millionaires also in my group. But when I thought about it more, the person that I am really speaking to is that first generation. And I'm not just talking about immigration. I'm talking about anyone who's the first generation in their family to say, I'm not going to repeat the cycle of just working hard and expecting that to be my ticket to financial stability. And so even if it's a family, let's say, whose family has been here for hundreds of years, I have had so many clients who said, well, I don't want to repeat what my parents did, who either worked really hard, long hours, even if they were making a lot of money, but they were never around, or there were parents who, you know, were trying their best, but could never make ends meet. And what is really fascinating about this group of people is that they are also very much craving community and conversation around money, not just being told what to do and being held accountable, which is why we focus so much on habits versus just learning the thing. A lot of us already know what we're supposed to be doing with money, but do we do it consistently? And it really helps to have a group of people who are doing it with you.
Well, 2024 marked the 50th anniversary of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act of 1974, which protected women's rights to access credit. And before that became into law, women needed their husbands, fathers, or brothers to co-sign for a loan, credit card, or even a bank account. And anecdotally, I can tell you, my parents at one point, my dad was in the Air Force, and in the 70s, they were stationed in Alabama. My mom has a story where she went to open a bank account and was told that she couldn't until my father joined her. And that's kind of, you know, a little chuckle there, but more a chuckle of, whoa, that's insane. I can't imagine living in that world. And the 70s were not all that long ago. So the fact that women haven't been able to use credit cards independently as long as men have, can you tell us what role that plays in women's spending or saving habits today?
Yes. Anecdotally, I have a similar story. My mom really couldn't get by on a lot of financial things without my father also signing off on it, even though at times she was the one who was more financially responsible. And I can even say personally for me, I'd love to say we've gotten really far along, but we really have not made enough progress. Women own about a third of the wealth that men own in the US, and that's separate from the income gap. So a lot of people know about, you know, pay gap for gender, but the actual net worth gap of women versus men is even worse. And it also becomes very apparent in retirement years when women who have worked just as hard and who have tried just as much to be financially responsible are retiring with a third of what men are getting, even though actually women live longer and usually are also the ones who are thinking about legacy for their children, right? So it's something that actually makes me pretty angry at times, if I'm being honest, which is what drives me to do what I do. But what I think it really has changed the narrative on is at least women are a lot more aware that actually we don't necessarily need men, and we don't actually technically need men anymore for our financial decisions. But I also think that there is a lot of work to be done in giving women more than just the basics, because one of my biggest gripes right now with financial education in particular is that women are only being taught the basics of finances and the basics of investing as though we can't handle any more of that. And we want to bring that leveled up with what men are being taught.
My guest today is Bernadette Joy. She's a personal finance author, and her new book is titled Crush Your Money Goals. When we get back, we'll discuss some techniques to pay down debt. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and you're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and for Mike Collins. My guest today is Bernadette Joy, a personal finance author and Charlotte resident who understands the complexities around money management decisions. She joins us to discuss her life and her new book, Crush Your Money Goals. Before we dive into our next topic, I wanted to circle back to income gaps. In 2018, research out of American University found that women tend to use credit cards as a way to bridge income gaps, and the research found that men are less cautious when it comes to using credit. Let me first ask you, do you find that to be true in the work that you do?
100%. A lot of the people who enter into coaching with me and who have then become the basis of the book have been people who initially started off with wanting to pay off credit card debt. And the fallacy that I think a lot of people misunderstand about people with credit card debt is not necessarily that they are irresponsible spenders. There's this idea that, oh, it's just women with like the bags full of shoes. But actually, the vast majority of people that I've worked with who have credit card debt are people who've experienced some sort of income gap, whether it was temporarily or an ongoing thing where they just could not keep up with their bills. And there's also the shame of not wanting to actually go maybe talk to someone and get a personal loan or to go to the bank and get a loan to cover those gaps. So instead, they're putting it on credit cards, not realizing that right now credit cards range from on the low end, 5%, but some credit cards are up to 33% in interest. And then people are getting crushed by this credit card debt that maybe happened because one week their paycheck was different than they expected, or they lost their job and they had to close the gap before they found a new one.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is about how you start this whole process. Because one of the biggest challenges of paying down debt, whether that's credit card debt or debt from a personal loan or mortgage, is, you know, where do you start? So let's start there. Where should people who don't consider themselves to be very financially savvy or they're intimidated by it, where do you even start? Where do you tell people that they should begin their journey?
Yes. So it sounds corny, but the first thing I tell people to do is to repeat after me, which is, I am not bad with money. And most people say, I'm bad with money. And they've never said, I am not bad with money. So that's a good place that we just always kick off my meetings with. And then the tactical thing that we do is we start with curating our accounts. It also happens to be the C and the crush in what I teach people. And what I mean by curate accounts is the vast majority of people that I have worked with don't actually know how much exactly they owe, what the interest rates are, and how that compares to the assets they have on hand. They just look at their credit card debt and they look at their cash in their savings or their checking account. They're like, that's all I know. Not realizing that maybe they own property, maybe they have a 401k, maybe they have investments, maybe they have, true story, I had a client who had savings bonds from an aunt 30 years ago and they totally forgot about it, right? So when I say curate your accounts, it means literally go and find every account that has your name on it, that has money going in or out of it, and get it consolidated into one place. There are many tools out there. I happen to use this tool, Monarch Money, not sponsored at all by them. I just really like their tool. And what it does is that it allows you to enter your usernames and passwords for all of the different accounts that you have. So you can actually see it all in one place. And that one thing, which sometimes for some people, it takes them several months because they have to go track down these old accounts and stuff. So it's okay. Take your time with doing that. But once you have all of that information in one place, what I found is that everyone that I've talked to, there has not yet been a single person who was accurate about what they thought their finances actually looked like. And the vast majority of people thought it was worse than it actually was. So the people who had debt, they thought it was way worse than what they actually saw. And what it also does is it helps you to understand, well, if I have all this money in savings and checking, then how does that compare to what I have in my debt? And then we can start coming up with a plan. But what a lot of people do is like, oh, I have all this debt. I just have to pay it off as quickly as possible, not looking at their total picture first.
The fact that people don't understand how much they have in the bank or in debt, I mean, that kind of, just hearing you talk about that, it makes me feel like there's a big, I know there's fear, but there's also like an avoidance about talking with money and dealing with money. Do you find that when you are working with clients?
100%. There is so much avoidance around talking about money. And going back to what we talked about earlier with women, there has been this rhetoric. So like you said, it's only been 50 years since we were able to sign off on our own documents. But there's always this idea from some of my women too, especially if they're married or if they have a financial advisor already, or their dad told them something, that they're not as good, which I found so interesting because studies actually show that women are actually inherently good investors because we are able to multitask a lot of things and come up with a decision. And the four fear responses, which is based off of psychology, I actually have a psychology degree, and I learned that there's a lot of people know there's fight, of course, there's flight, there's fear, but what there's fight, flight, freeze. And then the fourth one that most people don't identify is what they call fawn. And this is the one I see most common with my female clients. And the fawn one is, I just want to look like I'm doing a good job. And I want people to think that I have my stuff together. And I think you're a great mentor, but then inside they're dying. Mm. Right. And inside they're saying, I'm not a good person. I'm terrible with money. I make bad choices. And the problem, obviously, with any of the fear responses other than fight is that it doesn't really move your financial progress forward. So what I want to impart upon people, and especially as we talk to women specifically, is that if you're waiting until you're not afraid anymore to make money choices, you will never make money choices because they're all scary, truthfully.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so rather than waiting until you're unafraid, how do we move through the fear? And it's usually some form of fight.
Well, the talk of fear lends itself to another talk I wanted to have, which is about shame. And you write a lot about healing your money wounds, which can be generationally passed down to you. And it's also passed down through society, too. So when people feel inadequate when it comes to money because of past mistakes, maybe they've made a bad investment or they didn't start saving when they quote unquote should have started saving. How do you coach people to move past that, those past mistakes? Because there can be a lot of shame and there can be a lot of embarrassment with that.
Absolutely. I personally have had a lot of shame. I'm going to share an anecdotal story that I think illustrates this. So on Sunday, shout out to Eastway Rec Center, because I didn't know it existed. And I signed up for the first time beginner swimming lessons for adults. And I have had shame for 39 years that I don't know how to swim as an adult. And I decided finally to go sign up for these swimming lessons. And I put out on my social media the other day, I said, in slightly embarrassing news, I have signed up for swimming lessons for adults because I don't know how to swim as a 39-year-old. And I got 700 responses of people, right? It was just me just putting it out in the universe. And I had 700 people respond to me saying, there's nothing to be ashamed of. Like, that's great. You're inspiring me to go take swimming lessons. I don't know how to swim. And I also found out anecdotally that a lot of people also don't know how to ride a bike, change a tire, or so from this conversation, right? And so when I say that as an anecdotal story about money, it's the same thing with all of us. I have not yet met a single person who doesn't have some sort of shameful transaction they've made in the past, a spending choice they made in the past, a bad investment in the past. But we hold those as though something is wrong with us versus having conversations with other people and just putting out there and saying, you know what, I made a really bad choice here. Anyone have any advice on how I might be able to do that? Now, of course, we don't just take random advice from the internet. This goes back to finding people who are well-versed in this area. But the biggest way that I have found people to overcome that shame is to actually share that story. And then 9 times out of 10, you're going to get commentary from people like, oh, I did that too. Oh, I've done that 100 times, right? And the other piece that I think helps with getting over the shame aspect of it is to, and it sounds very corny, again, as a financial coach, but it is to have a budget. It is to have a budget. Because what ends up happening is a lot of people will feel shamed about that one or two splurges they did over the month, but don't give themselves credit for the other 80% of things that they actually did really well. You know what? You splurged on two things, but you paid your rent on time. You paid your utilities on time. You paid for your kids' after school program. Like, kudos to you on that too. So having a budget actually factually shows you what you've done with your money this month and says, you know what? I actually did a pretty good job.
Yeah. Yeah. What advice do you have for folks that have maybe never budgeted? It wasn't like part of how they grew up. They were just told like you better save money and having cash on hand is a good thing, but never, you know, had the spreadsheet. Does it have to be a spreadsheet, or, you know, how do you start?
Yes, I hate spreadsheets. as someone who used to work at full time in spreadsheets, I actually think spreadsheets are the worst way to do a budget because one, it is static, as in it doesn't actually track your unless you're able to do like really complicated macros and stuff, you can't really track your progress over time. Two, it's incredibly boring and soul sucking to do it in a spreadsheet. And three, what I found with spreadsheets is that people end up spending way too much time tracking expenses versus actually planning. And what people don't understand about budgeting is that the reason they probably avoided it is because it is tedious if you act as it is tedious if you act as though it is a tracking exercise. So instead, I tell people that budgeting is planning. So the way that I hold an analogy to that is, would you rather plan your vacation, which is what's much more exciting, looking at the things that you want to do for a vacation, or after the fact, track every little expense when you come back from vacation? People are mostly doing the latter and not the former. So think about it as, oh, I'm planning for this upcoming month. And the specific way that I teach people is to break it down into, start off with just three buckets. There's strive, revive, and survive. And strive is anything that's helping you grow your net worth. So paying down your debt, investing, saving your emergency fund, anything that increases your net worth. Revive, which most people are surprised that I let them have in a budget, which is everything that makes you happy, but you don't necessarily need. So for me, it's dance classes, it's the swimming lessons, it's anything that is not a necessary item. And then survive, which is your five basic categories that you need in order to just live day to day. So it's your housing, it is your utilities, it is your transportation, your food, and your health expenses. And just start with those three buckets of putting those things into those three buckets, and you'll start to see what patterns emerge and where you need to improve.
Along those lines, one tip that you had that I thought was really smart, but I will be honest with you, it does seem a little daunting, is to have an annual audit with yourself where you sit down and you put like kind of all your cards on the table with yourself. How do you suggest that people approach it? And like, is there a way to make that fun at all?
Yeah. Yes, it is incredibly daunting. One way you can make it fun is you can do it with a friend that you actually trust and have either cookies or drinks or something to make it a little less painful, which is what I do. I have a girlfriend who I met when I first moved to Charlotte, and we've been doing annual planning together ever since then, now 10 years ago. So we look forward to it every month. I mean, every year. But specifically, when I talk about an audit, one area that sounds incredibly boring is to audit your insurances. So if you do nothing else, and I know it's in the news cycle about insurance and stuff right now with health insurance specifically, it is imperative. If you hear nothing else from this talk today, is to go and check on all of your insurances and make sure that you are paying the appropriate amount and getting the appropriate coverage and understanding what that coverage does. Because as it's shown in the media cycle recently, that, you know, health insurance companies are not doing right by us right now. And so understanding what you actually have in terms of your FSA, which is your flexible spending accounts, your health spending accounts, and your deductibles and everything, that is just a good practice to do every year. And the fun part of it is to go and get discounts, in my opinion. So if you look at this and you're like, feel like I'm spending too much for absolutely no service, then this is the time once a year to go to your car insurance, your home insurance, your life insurance, your health insurance, all of those insurances, and shop around for a better deal. And I don't know about y'all, but I find it really fun when I find extra money for little to no work other than just calling a bunch of people and telling them I'm going to move elsewhere unless you give me a fair rate.
Well, another annual conversation that you urge people to have is a conversation with family about money. As parents age, you point out, it's important to have these conversations on a yearly basis because the care may change, money may change that a parent has. But I feel like, anecdotally speaking, a lot of us like have the scary conversation with our parents about last wishes or their financial plans. And we're like, okay, check, did it. We had the talk. But you're saying, well, don't just have the one talk, have it every year. How did you come to that?
I would love to say that it was pure wisdom, but actually it came out of necessity. My husband's parents retired recently. And then as I mentioned earlier, my father passed away in 2021, and we were on the back end of not having enough of those conversations. And so please use me, ladies and gents, as a cautionary tale to not wait until it's absolutely necessary to have these conversations. If we had had even two or three more conversations, the transition for my father and my mom would have been a lot less traumatic. So take that with a grain of salt. But specifically, and again, it doesn't sound fun at all, but we can make it a little fun, is that I highly recommend, whether you are old or young, if you have any sort of assets, is you need to have an estate plan. And it can be as simple as a lot of employers actually have an estate plan template that you can start off with and then get it notarized. So you don't have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars in an estate plan if you don't have a ton of assets right now. But what it does is it forces you to have the conversation with yourself, at least, of like, well, what would I want to happen with my assets, but also with my health directives? And also, who do I really care about? And my husband and I actually just redid our estate plan this past year, and I was dreading it personally. Even as a personal finance expert, I was like, I know I need to do this, but who wants to talk about dying right now? But I was very fortunate that I had an estate attorney here in Charlotte who I had met through an accelerator program that we were in together, and she was so kind. And she had a similar story that her father died when she was really young, and so that's the reason that she does what she does. So when I say have the annual conversation with your parents, it makes it a lot easier if you've done the exercise yourself. It feels very odd to be like, hey, parents, what are your wishes for your assets and stuff when you have never done it for yourself? So I highly recommend for people to have an estate plan and then at least check on it once a year for yourself. And that might prompt the conversation very casually over Thanksgiving dinner or something. Say, hey, I just happened to update my estate plan and I decided that I'm going to have a karaoke party for when I pass away. That's what your job, y'all. And that can open up the conversation of what they might want to do too.
My guest today is Bernadette Joy. She's a personal finance author, and her new book is called Crush Your Money Goals. We're going to have more after this quick break. I'm Sarah D'Elia. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia. We're talking about the complexities of money management with Charlotte author Bernadette Joy. Her new book is called Crush Your Money Goals, 25 Smart Money Habits to Save, Invest, and Fast Track Your Financial Freedom. So I know this is a book about money and management, but I also feel like there may be a little bit of relationship advice in this book as well. You talk a lot about how you may be ready to go on this journey to better manage your money, but the person you're partnered with, that might not be a priority for them, or they may not be ready to really take a hard look at themselves. So what do you do then if you're not on the same page about really looking at your money? What do you advise people?
Yes, that is aside from credit card debt, the next best reason that people come and speak to me as a coach is because they're not on the same page with their partner or spouse, and they want to be able to convince them that they need to go on this journey. And the unfortunate thing that they end up hearing from me that they don't like is that there is no convincing them and just speaking. You need to do what you want them to do as well. So the best advice that I can give to folks who want people in their lives, whether it's their partner, spouse, or even a family member or friend, to get on the same page with them is to, going back to the budget, do your own budget for, and this is the hard part, at least 3 months. If you can stick to a budget for 3 months, then you're already 80% better, in my opinion, of being able to stick to it in the long run. Most people do a budget for 1 or 2 months and then they quit after that. And what I found is after that 3 months, then you can have a more specific and informed conversation with your spouse or partner to say, hey, I've been doing this exercise for the last 3 months, and here's what I learned. I learned that I'm spending this much on food. I'm learning that we're spending this much on housing. I'm learning that I tend to spend more money on clothes during this time versus that time. And you start to get more data in having that conversation versus, hey, I think you're spending too much money and I don't like it. That's usually what those conversations are. And so having an actual information-based conversation that shows that you've created the habit for yourself, here's what I learned. Most partners don't want to feel like they're dragging their partners down. So if you are the one who's acting as the role model to say, hey, your journey is your journey, my journey is mine, I'm going to go in financial freedom. You can come along or you can not. And I say that because that's literally the conversation I had with my own husband, because 8 years ago, when I found out I had all those student loans, my husband said to me, well, what's the big deal? All of our friends have student loans. All of our friends have mortgages. It's not that bad. And we have a decent, you have a decent job. I have a decent job. We'll be fine. And I said, cool for you, bro. I call my husband, bro. cool for you. I don't want to be like everybody else, because everyone else I know is really stressed out and it's going to have to work for another 40 years. So it's a really tough conversation to have if you are just coming at it from the perspective of like, I think you should just do what I'm not already doing myself. It's a different conversation if you have been budgeting consistently, you know your own numbers, and now you're just sharing what you've been doing versus telling them what you think they should be doing.
Well, you mentioned student loans, so we're going to jump over there. According to Bankrate, 86% of Black students take out loans for college compared to 68% of white students. More Black and Hispanic students say they've delayed financial decisions because of student loan debt compared to white counterparts. What specific advice do you have for people of color who are looking to manage their money? I mean, is the advice different than you would give to a white person?
It is, in my opinion. There is and I mentioned this earlier, it's similar in the Asian community as well, that education is not only important, it is your ticket out of poverty. And what that ends up happening and manifesting, which is what I did, is that almost all of the Black women specifically that I have coached all have multiple degrees. Some of them even have 3 degrees. I'm not even just talking about a bachelor's and a master's. They have multiple degrees, because we keep getting this rhetoric that, oh, the more degrees that we get, then people will then take us seriously and then we'll get paid more. And I have had many questions from people specifically about doing master's programs and whether or not it makes sense to do those. So my best advice specifically for women of color is absolutely, you know, college can get us a long way, but first, pay off your student loans on your undergrad before you go and get a master's, unless it's absolutely necessary for your field, i.e., you know, becoming a doctor or becoming an attorney. But a lot of people are getting master's degrees in things like social degrees or other degrees that can wait a little bit longer until you've had some experience. And so pay off your undergrad degrees first. And then the next biggest thing, which I talk about extensively in the book, is we need to negotiate our pay. First, the degrees, I promise you, as someone who got a master's degree worth 6 figures, it did not increase my income just by having the degree. What actually increased my income was being able to be a really good negotiator. And so I give some specific tips on how you can negotiate, which no master's degree ever really teaches very well, even for me as an MBA. And so before you go and get multiple degrees, which is where I see a lot of the student loans coming from, is making sure that you, at least in undergrad, have an understanding of how you're going to get the money back on your student loans. Some of the women that I have coached who have been women of color who have 20 years worth and they're still paying off student loans. We don't want to be paying student loans for 20 years. So undergrad first, pay them off, then potentially get a master's, but only get a master's if you know for sure that you understand how that's going to increase your income, and then learn how to negotiate before you go get a master's degree.
Okay. And when you talk about negotiate, I assume you mean like salary for a new job.
I mean in two senses. So salaries, absolutely, but also negotiating in a lot of different areas within your personal finance. So for example, a common thing, this actually just happened with my in-laws recently, is my in-laws are buying a new home and they just took the first mortgage mortgage offer that was given to them because it was the builder that gave it to them. It was terrible. It was a really bad structured loan. And so my husband and I taught them, hey, you need to go back to them and ask them these questions. And they were able to get a significantly better rate for a lot less money. So when I say negotiate, absolutely in salary, but also negotiating in anything that is a relatively large purchase. And then if you're an investor or you're an entrepreneur, learning how to negotiate deals that are going to help you increase your income.
Well, according to the USDA, it costs more than $230,000 to raise a child in this country. And that data is from 2015. So with inflation, it's more like $280,000 at least. For some, having children comes down to a solely financial decision, especially when we look at millennials and Gen Z. What is your advice to people who want to have a family, but they also don't want to go bankrupt?
Yes. So I will never pretend to have the best parenting advice or anything because obviously I'm not even a parent myself. What I can say from having coached many other parents is number one is you want to actually get some facts and figures of what some of the costs are locally in where you live. Because, for example, I have a family who lives in Boston. Their childcare expenses are very different from what it looks like here in Charlotte. And you also want to look at other things that would change your budget. So again, if you're already doing your budget, which I'm hoping you're doing before you have children, is you're looking at, well, what would change with our childcare costs? What would change with our commuting costs? What would change with our food costs and then our health costs? Because obviously diapers and all of that are going to be included. And people always think about the first 2, 3 years as a baby, but they don't think beyond that. So the other thing that you want to think about is, can I afford to also start putting a little bit away for this child as early as possible? That should be part of your budget too. That being said, sometimes people have kids and it was not in the plan, or sometimes people have kids and they didn't hear this talk before they had the kids. And so one of the things that I have learned from my clients is that a lot of parents are spending more sometimes than necessary because they're trying to make up for the things that they didn't have as a child. And I find that really fascinating. So I have a client, for example, who, even though she cannot afford to do some self-care for herself, she will never let go of her child's music lessons because she herself always wanted to learn how to play the violin. Right. And the best advice that I can give to parents who want to do that is that really the greatest gift that you can give to your child is to make sure that they don't have to take care of you later. So getting your finances in order, paying down your debt. I have a specific case study actually with my in-laws, my brother and sister-in-law. I helped them plan for their second child. And we did that by ensuring that my brother-in-law's student loans were paid off before they had their second child. And now they are significantly, better off for that because all that money that used to go towards student loan debt now gets to go to the kids' swimming lessons or whatever it is. But imagine if they were still holding on to that debt and they had to balance all of that.
Well, you push for every dollar to be allocated, as in no leftover money. And this might surprise some listeners because I mean, personally, I feel like it's kind of ingrained into us as, when we're young, that if you have leftover money and you had a budget, like that's a good thing. You save some or, but why is that maybe not a good thing to have leftover money?
Yes, leftover money is bad. We're going to say that over and over again to people until it's ingrained the opposite direction. Leftover money is bad because what tends to happen with leftover money? We usually try to spend it somewhere that we didn't intend to, right? And so, what I suggest for people to do is at the top of every month, in my case in particular, for all of my students, I suggest we do it the first Sunday of every month, where we look at all of the things that we are potentially going to spend on in this given month, that survive, revive, and strive I talked about earlier. So not just your basic living expenses, but is there a birthday party this month? Is there a holiday this month? Is there a vacation we want to go to? Do I want to go to a dance lesson, right? And then what you want to do is you want to look at all the potential income that you have in this given month. And I notice, especially in Charlotte, there's a lot of rhetoric around the side hustle in Charlotte. We have to have two or three jobs to be able to make it in this town, right? And so a lot of people are looking at the side hustle money as like extra money or leftover money versus no, you should also budget where you want that money to go before it even comes in. And what this does for everyone that has come through the Crush Your Money Goals program is that by allocating every dollar at the top of the month, even if you are not exactly accurate, you're more likely to actually spend on the things that you intended to versus, in my case, having that random trip to South Park Mall when I didn't need to be there. So I really encourage people to not think of it as leftover money, but to think of it as like, wow, a gift that I don't want to waste. Where can I put it that it's actually going to make good use?
Well, there are costs that come up while people are trying to save money or budget their money better, like an unexpected hospital bill or deciding, oh, we weren't going to have kids and now we are going to have kids. What advice do you have for someone who keeps trying to get ahead? Like, you just feel like you keep trying, but it feels like you're taking 2 steps forward, 3 steps back, and you're kind of treading water.
First of all, I feel for you, and you are absolutely not alone. I'll give a prime example from my life. I finally got the high-paying job that I thought I was going to get. And then 3 months into the job, caught a kidney stone that sent me to the hospital and put me out of work for a month. Okay. And that kidney stone surgery cost me $10,000 out of my own pocket. So that extra money that I thought I was going to make from making more money just got completely obliterated in one go. Now, what I can say for folks who are feeling that way, one of the habits that I highly, highly recommend to do, if nothing else, is what I call the cash flow cushion. And it is different from an emergency fund, because we've all heard about emergency funds, three to six months worth of savings, which, by the way, I think is too much for most Americans right now. I tell people work on a 1 month emergency fund instead of a 6 month emergency fund, because a lot of us can't even get to the next paycheck, right? But the cash flow cushion is simply those 5 expenses of survive that I talked about earlier. So your health, your housing, your utilities, your transportation, and your food for 1 month. And you have that money saved up as long as it takes you to get it saved up inside your checking account. And what that does for people who have that cash flow cushion is that it allows us to start getting out of this paycheck to paycheck mentality of I have to wait for my next paycheck. I've had people who make multiple 6 figures and are still waiting for the next paycheck to pay their bills. So regardless of income, if you have this cash flow cushion, it can allow you to not have to think about your next paycheck and instead start focusing on some other areas in your life. But at least it gives you the peace of mind that for 30 days, you won't have to worry about the roof over your head or food in your belly. And you can feel like, all right, a little bit more resilient on focusing on some of those harder things.
We are winding down this hour of Charlotte Talks, but I did want to bring this up. I was looking at your website before our conversation, and there's a great video that you have kind of talking about the work that you do and hearing from some of the people that you've helped. And this quote that you said really stuck with me. You said, money is not like learning math. It's more like learning music. Can you explain that?
Yes. As someone going back to what you said about people who feel like they can't make it forward, I have been on and off taking piano lessons for 30 years since I was 10, and I'm still not good at it. And I recently, during the pandemic, I took some music lessons from a local company here in Charlotte. And after 2 lessons, I said to my piano teacher, I said, I'm gonna quit. I don't even know how to play this Adele song. What's the point? And he said to me, you have taken 2 lessons, ma'am. What is your expectation that you would be able to play an entire song by now? And that is actually how I see most people treating money management and skills. They're like, oh, I'm going to do a budget one time. I'm going to put my stuff in my net worth in Monarch Money one time. And then they think like everything is going to be fixed. And so what I really encourage people is that when I make the analogy to music is that money is really a long-term skill. Even if you're the best pianist in the world, there's still other things that you can always get better at in terms of how you play and the mood and the tone and all of those things. And the same thing goes for money, is that it takes a long time. It takes a lot of patience. Just because you can't play a whole song right now doesn't mean that you're bad at it. And I also think there can be a lot of joy found in learning money, just the way that people have joy in learning music. If you play the kind of things that you want to play, like for me, music wouldn't be as fun for me if I was playing, you know, hard metal rock versus K-pop, which I like K-pop music. And so find the genre of music as well as money management that makes you feel happy.
That's all the time we have this morning. I want to thank my guest, Charlotte author Bernadette Joy. Her new book is Crush Your Money Goals, 25 Smart Money Habits to Save, Invest, and Fast Track Your Financial Freedom. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
I'm Sarah D'Elia, filling in for Mike Collins. This has been Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.